This call
Okay, the
is being recorded by the meeting organizer. By staying on the call, you are giving your consent to being recorded.
Okay, we are now being recorded. I want to point out to all of you that we are able to give you access to this recording. At the end of the session, I'll get a link, and if you'll let me know that if you want the recording, I can send you that link, and then you can access that link and listen to it separately. If we go too fast or to something that you didn't quite get, or to someone who wasn't able to make the call and you wanted to listen to some of the discussions, I would certainly provide that information for you. Okay, one of the things that logistically I want to make sure and point out is that we want everyone to put your phones on mute, and you do that by hitting *6. That'll prevent background noise. Just don't forget to put *6 again if you want to talk, because we won't be able to hear you while your phone's muted. If the background noise gets too bad, I can do a muting of all of the calls. I'd rather not do that, because I'd rather have people ask questions as we go through the process. But if I do need to make a muting of all the calls, I will do that. I will let you know before I do that, and then we'll have to refer all questions to be answered after the discussion is over with, and at which time I will unmute the call. Also, it's important for there not to be a delay in the transition of the PowerPoint slides that's showing up on my computer screen and your computer screen for you to close all programs that are not currently being used by this webinar. For example, if you have your email, Word, other internet websites currently up on your screen, please shut those down. Having those up on your side actually limits the bandwidth and therefore causes transmission delays from my computer to the webinar attendees. So if you close any other active things that you have going on a computer, it would help everybody. Okay, this is just a summary of what our goals are today. As Gloria mentioned earlier, this is primarily designed to give you information about the funding opportunities starting July 1, 2016, specifically as relates to the fact that we are now going to be entering a full implementation of WIOA. We'll be spending a lot of time talking about that issue, as well as the new uniform guidance requirements that are also in effect as we speak. We'll be talking about the performance reporting requirements as relate to the new WIOA implementation. And for sure, we're going to spend some time talking about the submission requirements for the RFA that's going to be used to get the funding to you starting July 1, 2016. There are some special conditions for this funding, and we'll talk about those as well. This is our agenda today. We've already done the welcome and introductions and talked about the goals. As I mentioned, we're going to be doing an overview of the request for application, talking about all the specifics associated with preparing and submitting the application. But we also want to focus on some of these other things because they're critical to the process of getting your application reviewed and approved in a timely manner, and also to be able to make the program move successfully throughout the program year. And that is a self-assessment report form. For sure, the budget and all the issues associated with the budget narrative. There's a requirement for a staffing form. I want to make sure we talk about that as well. The balanced performance measures is the summary document that actually talks about the performance that we're required to submit on a quarter basis to the Department of Labor. And so we'll spend some time talking about that, as well as special conditions in Attachment D related to the way in which we make this program work really well in Florida. We'll certainly reserve some time for participant questions. If you want to ask the questions as we go along, I have no problem with that. Just let us know your name, what organization you're from, and then what the question is, and that way we can all benefit from the question. But if you want to reserve your questions to the end, that's fine as well. Also, I want to share with you that if you want to have any questions submitted after the conference call, you can certainly email them to me, and I'll be glad to respond to those questions. I'll just make sure that I create a frequently asked questions list on our website so that everyone gets access to the answers to all those questions. Okay, let's start by looking at the RFA. And I think the most important thing to really focus on is why we're doing this at all. This doesn't sound like it's a whole lot of stuff right here, but I'd really like you to focus on the individual component parts of what this is saying. Take a look at the first three words, for example, strengthen the ability. What is it you think that we have to do to strengthen anybody's ability to do anything? Just think about that. You come into this kind of program with certain abilities and skills, and we want to strengthen those. So how do we do that? Well, as you typically know, we have to provide things like education and training and support and other kinds of training to get you to enhance your skills. That sometimes it's easier said than done. Sometimes it takes a little bit longer and certainly costs money. So because we're about strengthening people's ability, we have to really focus on what that means, particularly as we focus on the fact that we're not all the same. And so strengthening my ability might be different than it is strengthening somebody else's ability. So this, as a purpose, is an important thing to really focus on and think about as we move forward. The next key word I want you to focus on is the word eligible. That sounds like the standard kind of thing you'd put in a purpose statement. Well, you got to be eligible, right? What a lot of people don't realize is to be an eligible migrant seasonal farm worker, there are very specific criteria as relates to your history as a farm worker, your poverty level going into this situation. What a lot of people also don't realize is just how broad that definition is. It's not as small as you might think. There are, especially under WIOA now, some additional eligibility opportunities that we didn't have before under WIOA. So we want to focus a lot on the eligibility portion of the program that we're doing every day. The next portion here I think is important is that section where it talks about and their families. This program is very unique in that we don't always just support the farm worker. We can also support and often do the dependents. The families are just as qualified for this program through the parent farm worker. So we need to really focus on the processes that we use to make that happen. And this last piece, which I think is probably the most important, but certainly not the easiest, and that is achieving economic self-sufficiency. Well, how does anyone do that in this society, in today's situation and what we have to deal with? Just think about what it means to be able to be self-sufficient economically. That means you can pay for your own house, and you can pay for your own car, you can send your children to college, you know, all on your own without having to get any support from anybody else. Well, how do we make that happen? Well, to get all of that together from someone that maybe is coming to us with a lot of individual challenges and maybe some disadvantages and things that they're having to overcome is a real mountain to climb sometimes. But we do it very well, and we certainly know how to do it. But we just want to make sure that we continue to do things that way, particularly as we get new federal legislation that we're going to talk about in just a little bit. Okay, everyone always has a question about the money. So I just want to make sure that you understand that the way that we allocate dollars to grantees is through a formula process. And this formula is a combination of looking at the total population of farm workers that you're serving in your area and your region and prior performance. We combine those two in a formulaic way, and then a proportionate share of the amount of money that we get from the federal government to each grantee. And that will change, of course, as we get more or less money from the federal government. It's important to point out at this juncture that 16-17 is going to be a continuation year. That's why this is a request for application, RFA, and not a request for proposal, RFP. We got to this point, even though we didn't really want to, because we've had delays from the federal side of the house in terms of getting our final regulations posted. We were told initially they were going to be posted back in late 2015, but we are now advised we're not going to get our final regulations until June 2016. In addition to that, our funding opportunity announcement, which is the way in which we apply for the dollars for the state of Florida, has also gotten delayed, and we're probably not going to get that opportunity announcement until sometime late April, early May timeframe. And the reason why it's important is not just because it helps define for us the things we put in the application, but also, most importantly, how much money we're going to get. And based on how much money we get is how much we can then allocate to the grantees. So as a result of all that, it just made a lot more sense for us to do a continuation. If we did not do that, we would not be able to meet the guidelines provided to us under the Green Book to be able to get your award letter out to you by early July of 2016. We need to have time to post the RFA. We have to have time to give you to reply to it. We have to have time to review it. And now the other thing that's important to realize here is that if there's things that are outside of our anticipated guidelines, now we've looked at the law, we've had some interim guidance, we think we're pretty close, but if for some reason they give us more money or less money, or for some reason they change something in the performance specifications, we might have to do some tweaking of the RFA process as we do the allocation in July. So we'll certainly keep you posted on that as we go forward. We don't anticipate a whole lot of changes, though. As it stands right now, we have two different RFAs. One is for aid to districts, a little over $3 million, and one is for statewide emergency assistance. This is a centralized emergency assistance process that we started about 3 years ago. It's working really well. And it's focused on providing, and we'll talk more about this as we go through the slide presentation, assistance to help in emergencies, to stabilize the situation for family. If something happens, gets in the way, we don't want them all of a sudden to stop going to class or to stop the process. And so we provide this emergency assistance on an as-needed basis based on certain criteria for those folks that need it. The aid to districts is just a flat level funded from last year, and again, this might change based on the amount of funding, as indicated there in the slide, upon approval of the U.S. Department of Labor. Okay, one of the things I'd like you to make sure and do, if you haven't already started this process, is to have available both the PowerPoint and the RFA. Earlier this morning, I sent that out to everyone. I sent you a link to the RFA. I also sent out a copy of this PowerPoint, and the reason I suggest that you have both at the ready is that as we go throughout this presentation, there might be times when we refer to the RFA specifically. If you don't have it handy, I will try and at least tell you the page number so you can refer to it later, and therefore be able to look things up after the fact. One of the things I would like you to do is to make sure that you have the most current RFA. Since the RFA was originally posted back in February, there have been some modifications made. So please visit our funding website and make sure you have printed out the most recent RFA with the most recent information. The most significant change, I believe, that has just been changed is that we now have revised DOE 100A, which is the form that's used to submit the application. And I think that the biggest change has to do in that project application form has to do with the certification requirements that your agency head is going to be signing and agreeing to based on the new guidance we get from Uniform Guidance. So please make sure you take some time to read that language. That has changed. Now it makes it a lot more stringent that whoever signs these applications for funds, once having received them, make sure that they're being used in the way they're intended, or else there might be some stricter penalties involved if that's not the case. So please make sure that you make that make people aware of those changes to that certification statement. As we mentioned earlier, our target population are eligible migrant seasonal farm workers. For more information, refer to Attachments A and C of the RFA. It gives you all the specifics coming out of the Workforce Innovation Opportunity Act, Section 167, as relates to eligibility. We'll talk also, when we talk about special conditions, about some of the things that we're doing internally with our staff to make sure that everyone understands and clearly is able to adhere to the eligibility requirements that are outlined in WIOA. Okay, let's talk about preparing and submitting the application. Make sure you get the correct RFA, as I just mentioned earlier. This is the link. If you had difficulty getting to this link, call me, email me, and I'll walk you through how to get to this place on our DOE website. And I know that all of you do this, but I just need to say this. I need to have it on the record that I need you to read the entire RFA. Please don't assume that the RFA that you're reading today is the same one that was there last year, and therefore you can just cut and paste your application. Please do not do that. Read the entire RFA carefully, and then follow the instructions that are in this RFA. There's a combination of forms that are submitted in the application as well as narratives. Make sure that you do that in terms of of ensuring that you have everything there. The best strategy is to use the checklist, which is at the end of the RFA, and just make sure that you just go through there and you check off, okay, yes, I have this, yes, I have that. Let me share with you that people in Grants Management Office will do that. People in this office will do that. We're going to make sure that everything is in that application before we process it. Okay, let's talk about preparing the narrative components. 20-page maximum with the understanding that use this certain specific font size, and that you use these margins, that you double space it, and that you use single-sided pages. Again, this is right out of the RFA. It's important also that you complete the narrative using the same sequence presented in the narrative components section. That just saves everyone time. Please don't get creative and change things around. There's a specific sequence that's identified in the narrative components section. Just follow that sequence in your application. It will just make it easier for everyone. Okay, what I'd like you to do now is in the RFA, kind of work with me here, and go to page 10. Go to page 10 of the RFA. On page 10, you'll see this narrative format that we just talked about, but also the beginning of this section, which is the components of the narrative. I'm not going to go into a lot of detail for these. I just want to make sure that you clearly understand where they are and what they're talking about. Please note that the abstract is a one-page, let me just kind of say it again, one-page summary of the proposed project. It's important that you follow the guidelines in this RFA. The second section there has to do with the labor market assessment. Try and use current data. Sometimes I've seen in other applications use something that was used 5 years ago. That doesn't help us. Please take a look at your labor market as it stands today. This assessment component is not in the statewide emergency assistance RFA, by the way, because they have a different function and purpose in that RFA. And number three there, where you talk about project need, we clearly want to know that the geographic service areas of the proposed project are clearly identified and that you have looked at the focus that you're going to be providing throughout those different areas. And if you have any gaps or weaknesses in services, because of the way that you're organized or where you are in your service area, make sure that you identify those. Then number four, this is a multi-section. It's A through G for the project design and implementation. Again, this is on page 11 now. We start out by looking at letter A, objectives and timelines. Make sure that your objectives are clear, that they're measurable. They can be challenging but achievable. But most importantly, that they address the expected outcomes of the project and that they're aligned with and successfully address the needs of your target population. That's clearly important there. In letter B, assessing participants is a critical part of our process. Remember, we talked earlier about how in the world do you strengthen someone's ability and get them ultimately to achieve economic self-sufficiency. Well, it has to be with an initial starting of assessing accurately what the individual needs, what kind of training is required, what kind of referral might be necessary, what kind of plans are not in place related to employment, and that these plans are aligned both to their career aptitudes, but also the WIOA guidelines. So this process of assessing participants has to be clearly described in your project design. We're looking here for the fact that you've done a pretty good job of using approved assessments, not just for assessing educational perspectives, but also career perspectives, and that you're following the DOE guidelines for those kind of assessments. You're using some kind of approved career information delivery system, like the CUDR system that we've talked about before, and we can talk about as well moving forward. Technology-based English instructional program is extremely helpful for these kinds of assessments. Then as you talk about training and other services, I'm at letter C now, it's important that you start talking about the process that you're going to use to overcome educational barriers. How are you going to ensure that the participants are able to make their way through the different levels of training, that there's some kind of career pathway created, that there's some kind of related assistance provided if necessary. You know, all that criteria is something that's important, and when we talk later about the collaborative process, that you're reaching out and getting help from other agencies to help someone get through that process, because it may be that you're not able to do everything yourself. So again, those other services become real important, and they roll right into the next section, letter D, collaboration with local agencies. We're going to spend a lot of time talking about collaboration a little bit later, but just for sure in this section, it's clearly necessary for you to have identified who your primary folks are you're going to collaborate with, and that there be some kind of written agreement, collaboration between your agency and their agency, particularly as it relates to your local workforce development board, as you go into the letter E there. Under WIOA, there are certain things that are critically important in that memorandum of understanding. We do have some samples here in the state office. If you want access to those, give me a call and I can send those to you that have the major components in the MOUs that we think are necessary for this kind of MOU to take place. Just keep in mind now that your local career source regions sometimes are large and sometimes include several counties and areas, and so you need to make sure that your MOU is with the right centers within those regions for the right things. And so that's one of the things we'll be looking at as we look at those MOUs. In addition, for the collaborative piece, we do require that you have a local advisory council or committee in place, and that you have members on that council that represent the folks in your community that can help you move that participant forward to meaningful employment, that you're able to figure out how to access things, whether it be someone from the Career Source Center or someone from the educational system, someone from the training side of the house, an employer, Chamber of Commerce, all those kinds of folks in your community that can work with you to help that individual get that employment that we're looking for. Then finally, in letter G, this is the last section of this section, we want you to focus in your application on this evidence of capability. This is telling us that you've done this in the past successfully. You've had some obstacles with doing this, and here's some things you've done to overcome those things. So this is just telling us that yes, I can do this, done it before. Make sure you put in there, especially during this time period we talk about it here, sufficient evidence to indicate that you do have the capability to run this program. In the evaluation section, which is the next section that you're going to be talking about, you're going to tell us how you're going to put together some kind of internal evaluation process to assess whether or not your program is still moving forward in the right direction. One of those areas of evaluation has to do with a self-evaluation form that's in the attachments there. We'll spend some time later talking about that. But it's critically important that you do an assessment of your own program and say, okay, this is where I've done well, this is where maybe I have some gaps, and here's some plans I have in place to be able to close those gaps. That kind of external and internal evaluation is extremely helpful to us in making sure that you recognize the reality of where you are, and then you come up with some strategy of getting to where you want to be. And that's within the intent and guidelines of WIOA in terms of the purpose of the federal funding, which is that we figure out how to optimize the spending of those dollars, and we can only do that by recognizing where we're falling short. These other requirements here are also things that are important to pay attention to in the General Education Provisions Act. The support for reading strategic imperatives, don't whitewash those. You know, pay close attention to how you're doing these things. In the next section there in the budget, we're going to spend a lot of time a little bit later talking about the budget. Let me just say here that there needs to be a budget that's aligned and linked with the design. It doesn't make sense, does it, to say I'm going to spend money to buy computers if you're not going to use computers to do what you're doing. So the idea is that you're going to tell us in your budget how the money that we're giving you is going to help you get where we both want you to get to. Again, we'll spend more time talking about that in just a second. Okay, we need to make sure that you recognize that the application needs to be submitted not later than April 18, 2016. And let me explain to you what FDOE, if you didn't already realize it, means, but not later than. That means 5 p.m. on that day. If it's not at the desk of the grants management office where it's going to be date stamped and time stamped, then they will not accept it. It's as simple as that. So please make sure you do whatever you have to do internally to get it signed, reviewed, and approved, and then sent overnight, whatever you have to do to get it to the right place, and the address is right there, DOE on West Gaines Street, by not later than 5 p.m. on April 18, 2016. Please pay attention to the fact that you need to have not just the original, but three identical copies, because they will look for those. We want a total then of four copies, the three copies plus the original. And it's your responsibility to make sure that the copies are identical to the original. Okay. I want to talk just a little bit about the budget narrative form from two perspectives. One is that this form, which is in the attachment section of the RFA as an example, has to be included in the application in addition to the required budget narrative component, number 8. One does not substitute for the other. Okay, so make sure you tell us in the narrative how you're going to spend the money and how it makes sense to do it that way. But the form tells us the specifics of the dollars by object and function code. There's a form in the attachment section that will explain to you how to do that if you haven't done one of those before. In addition to that, it's important for you to recognize that we need you to send us an electronic copy of this DOE 101S at the beginning of the program year. This can be either in Word form or Excel. We prefer Excel because it's a lot easier to manipulate values in Excel, but we'll take Word. And that's linked to what we're going to talk about later, which is the fact that we are now able to do electronic 599 workbooks, which means that when you do an amendment, we have to change the document or we track disbursements, that we're able to do it electronically, but we have to link that to the budget. So if we don't have an electronic version of the budget, we literally have to recreate it here at the state office. So it makes it a lot easier for everyone because you already have it in your computer. If you just send us the electronic version here to the office, again, in Word or Excel, but preferably Excel, and that makes it a lot easier for us here in the office to track the budget moving forward. These are standard kind of budget things, and I'm going to invite Gloria to pitch in here if she would like to talk about these things in more detail. But please make sure that you tie your expenditures directly to the program goals. Make sure that you follow the guidelines of the fact that the expenditures must be reasonable, allocable, allowable, necessary. And if you don't know what those words mean or terms mean, please call me and we can talk about whether or not something is allowable or necessary. For sure, everyone should understand allocable because that means that our dollar is not being spent for some other program. Reasonable sometimes can be discussed, but often we can come to a pretty close idea as to what reasonable is if we just kind of ask the right questions. So please make sure that you don't just kind of carry things forward assuming that it's reasonable today because it was reasonable last year. It may not be. We need to go through the process and ask the right questions. One of the ways in which that happens, just looking at a piece of paper, is by looking at the descriptors that you put in next to the dollar amount. If you put no descriptors or very limited descriptors or very cryptic description of what you were going to buy, you don't talk about who it's for, what it's for, why it's being purchased, where it is, the quantity, and when the expenditure can take place, it's hard to make decisions about whether something is reasonable or allowable or necessary. So I'm just sharing with you that when we do the program review, if they're not there, we're going to come back to you and ask you for these types of descriptors for the line items. So it's better for everyone if we just put those in there at the beginning. Here's an example of the kind of things that are allowable in the budget. For sure, salaries, that can be put in as direct costs as long as they're reasonable. And we'll talk about how to get to that reasonable criteria when we talk about attachment D as relates to salaries. Professional technical services are allowable. Contractual services are allowable as long as they meet certain criteria. And one of the criteria, again, is discussed in attachment D, but we also have state guidelines associated with that. But we have to have a copy of the agreement so we can look at it and see whether or not it's meeting the guidelines. So please make sure you send that with the budget. If there's a third-party contract to hire a part-time teacher to teach English or to do anything else, we need a copy of that contract. If you're intending on buying any equipment with these dollars, it's allowable. Although we're not spending a whole lot of money on equipment these days, I try to discourage it because it takes money away from the participants. But if you do need that, you need to provide the protected equipment purchases form as provided in the RFA. You also need to make sure that you read and understand the uniform guidelines, new guidance on thresholds for purchasing computing devices. This is a new terminology that identifies that you can, the things that used to be equipment can now be considered a computing device, which means it's now treated as a supply versus a piece of equipment as long as it meets certain dollar thresholds. But I want to refer you to the Green Book, because the Green Book also has weighed in on this issue, and I think a lot of these guidelines dealing with equipment haven't changed very much as it relates to Florida. So please make sure you look at the Green Book as well as uniform guidance. The same issue with materials and supplies, those are allowable. Administrative costs, we'll take a very close look at administrative costs. We try and minimize administrative costs. Administrative costs, as you know, takes money away from the direct ability to use dollars to help our folks who need help. So we try and minimize secretaries or any kind of administrative things that would take away from those direct benefit types of expenses. Districts, you know, have certain requirements in terms of the Red Book for using function codes, where some of the other agencies might not have the same requirements. So just, again, follow the Green Book and the Red Book as it relates to your chart of accounts. We talked about contractual service agreements just a little bit. I do want to refer you to page 17 of the RFA. On page 17 of the RFA, it's got a whole section here where it talks about the statutes that you have to look at as it relates to contractual service agreements. What's important, I think, to realize is the applicant, that's you, that's the agency that's getting the money, are solely responsible for all the things that you contract for. So the subrecipients that provide services on your behalf are going to actually acting on your behalf, and you're responsible for what they do or don't do. So it's critically important that if you're going to subcontract services to another entity, a subrecipient, that you follow the State of Florida contract and grant user guidelines. If you're not familiar with those, please take a look at that. And again, there's a section there on page 17. Funded projects can be reimbursed to agencies in typically two different ways. One is through a cash advance system called CARDS, or through reimbursement performance, in which case you must invoice. At this juncture, I don't believe we have any reimbursement performance agencies, but again, that could change based on what we see in your self-evaluation, what we see in the submission that we get from you, what we see in your history. You know, if there's some kind of risk assessment that we have determined that we need to be careful for, then we do have the authority per the Green Book to do a reimbursement performance reimbursement as opposed to a cash advance. Okay, I mentioned this earlier, that the financial reports, that's the DOE 599, this tells us how much money you're spending every month. There's two things that are critically important in this slide to understand. One is the term initial, DOE 599. If you look at the RFA and look at the attachments, you're going to find an initial DOE 599. That's not just there for information purposes. You have to literally complete that DOE 599 as if it were going to be the one you're going to use the first month of your report as it relates to the budget amounts and as it relates to making sure that it's signed by the financial officer or authorized representative who's going to be signing your 599s. I can tell you last year I had at least two, maybe three 599s I had to send back to folks and get them signed because they thought it was just an example. That we thought, you guys thought, that we just wanted you to look at this 599, just kind of put some sample things in there and say, okay, this is what you're going to do in 599. It's not that. This initial DOE 599 will actually form the basis for putting together your E-599 workbook that we're going to use. So it has to be accurate. And in order for it to be accurate, it also has to be verified. So we have to align the object code and the budget to the budget or object codes on the 599 using these documents that you provide us in this application. And I need them signed by the financial officer or authorized representatives. And ideally, it would be helpful if the same person is going to be doing the E-599 submissions was also the same person that signed this 599, because that way we can get a pretty good idea that they understand how to do this process. For those of you that are not familiar with E599 workbooks, we can spend some time separately talking about that. But we have created a way of using an Excel auto-calculate type of workbook that we provide to all the budget officers that are going to be doing the 599s that can just put in the disbursements for that month. It all calculates it. You take that information and you create your DOE 599 that goes out to the comptroller's office, and then you send us a copy of that. We maintain the master E-599 here. What's nice about that is not only does it allow you to have accurate submissions, but it also accumulates across the months throughout the year so that we can pretty quickly tell whether or not an object code is getting overspent. And it'll actually pop up in red, and it'll show us whether or not you spent too much money in this object code, and therefore we need to look at maybe doing a budget amendment. So the E-599 workbook, we've used it now going on 3 years. It works really well. But we have to start out with the correct information, and that's why this initial DOE 599 is really critically important that it be submitted in your application accurately. As you all know, the last day to encumber funds is June 30th. That's the end of the program year, 2017. We do need the final fiscal report that we have to then reconcile to the comptroller your final fiscal issues for this program year by August 20th, 2017. Okay, we mentioned the OMB Uniform Guidance Implementation. We've been doing this for a while now, so everyone should be familiar with this. The last time we talked, the Green Book had not yet been updated. Well, it now has been updated. It's now available. It's critically important that you take a look at the new Green Book if you're not aware that it's there. One of the key things that has been changed in the Green Book is that the Uniform Guidance now calls for an agency risk assessment determination process. This allows the funding agency to take a look at the risk associated with a particular submission and make a funding decision before the funding is actually awarded, and this can be done in whole or in part. And I would refer you here to take a look at I think it's page 3 of the RFA. Yes, page 3, and there's a section at the bottom there where it talks about risk analysis. What I want you to point out to you is that the way that Florida is articulating the Green Book has decided to do this risk analysis is by the use of two different forms. One is a DOE 610 for school districts, state colleges, and state universities. The other is a DOE 620 for governmental and non-governmental entities. What I'd like to point out to you is that the 610 can remain in effect indefinitely as long as there are not any significant changes to the financial circumstances of the agency. If there are, then you would need to resubmit the DOE 610. That is not the case, however, for the DOE 620, the governmental and non-governmental entities. They're required to submit the 620 each fiscal year. So depending on the kind of agency that you are, you may have to do a 620 again, or if it's a 610, just make sure that you've already got a current 610 in place. It's not required that you submit it with this application. Believe me, they'll check to make sure that you have a current 610 or 620 in place before they process the grant application. If you do need to have any additional information, uniform guidance, there's a link here. I'd recommend that you go to that link. It gives you a lot of good information. But again, also refer to the Green Book to make sure that you understand how the Green Book is interpreting those uniform guidance guidelines in Florida. Okay, let's talk about the staffing breakout form. This is an important form for us because it not only gives us an idea as to what proportion of the dollars are being spent on salary and benefits, and that's an important number because if we spend too much on salary and benefits, it obviously doesn't leave very much for the participants. And there's actually some guidelines that we'll talk about in attachment D on parameters based on site size that we are going to enforce for salary and benefit totals. But the issue that I really want to focus on is that sometimes staffing changes. And when that changes, we don't have an accurate picture of what's going on unless you redo the staffing form. So it's critically important that if there is a change in staffing within the program year, that you update the staffing form. It's also important to point out that the staffing definition includes all kinds of staffing, And by that I mean that if you're actually providing services in your program where you're hiring someone, but it's not as an employee, but rather as a contracted services, it's still, from our perspective, staffing because it's a person. In some cases, I've seen situations where you've had someone on board, they were out for an extended period of time, and so you went to a temporary agency to get someone to fill in, and that's allowable, but I didn't know that was going on if there's been no update to the staffing form. So again, make sure the staffing form reflects your current, as of today, picture of what your staffing looks like, and if that changes, that you redo the staffing form. As we mentioned earlier, the staffing form is not a budget, but it must be the same as the budget, because otherwise it doesn't make any sense. If the budget says you're going to have X amount for salary, but the staffing form is a different amount, then the two aren't reconcilable. So we need to make sure that those dollar amounts are the same. Okay, we talked a little bit about this earlier, self-evaluation form. This is where you tell us how you think you did this past year. And I want to refer you, if you aren't aware of it, to attachment G, which is the balanced performance form in your RFA. This is where you look to see what your performance benchmarks are for this year. And if you're not there or don't think you're going to get there by the end of June, this is the form you tell us what you're going to do about it. This is going to acknowledge, yes, we realize we're short on our recruitment, or we realize we're short on average earnings, we realize we're short on employment retention rate. And so this is our plan to be able to fix that between now and the end of June, but also after that, starting July 1, with the new dollars that you're going to give us. So this is self-evaluation form. If you're not meeting your benchmark, you should literally have some type of corrective action plan identified in it that's going to show us how you're going to close that gap between where you should be and where you actually are. In addition to that, we want you to have some kind of strategy in place. For example, we're going to work more closely with local advisory council, or we're going to put this other strategy in place to be able to make this happen or that happen. It has to be realistic to make sure that it actually will happen and make sense. Okay, let's talk about the WIOA related changes. And Gloria touched on these earlier. I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time talking about this because we've already been discussing this for a while now, but I just want to make sure that you clearly understand where the federal government is going and where we're going as well. But part of what we're doing with these dollars is to provide workforce investment activities. What does that mean? It means that we're going to focus on training and education systems, which leads to employment. And it's not just any employment. This is high-wage, high-growth employment. But in addition to that, what also is allowable and encouraged is that we focus on self-employment opportunities, micro-enterprise development, that we focus on coordination of services through our one-stop delivery systems. What does that mean? That means what I was talking about earlier, that there isn't just a referral system, but you're coordinating services with the one-stop delivery system. So what that means to me is that sometimes, because we are serving the same clients, there might be a situation where we could pay for part of the workforce investment activities and the career source folks could pay for another part of the workforce investment activities. In other words, we can leverage our resources, combine them to help this participant get through the entire process. This requires a lot of coordination because it's not just a matter of putting something on a piece of paper. It means doing some sharing of processes, and we'll talk about those in just a second. Another allowable activity is career planning, and in fact, it's not just allowable, it's required. We need to have, under WIOA, a client-centered approach, which is going to lead ultimately to the building of this comprehensive individual employment plan, and that they have access to all the necessary workforce investment activities. But then after you do the plan, you have to create a way to get there. So this is where the career pathway development has to come into place. I know that you know this, but I just want to really focus on this word. You see that first word there? It says enabling education, training, support services. If your education and your training and support services is not enabling a participant to attain high-quality, high-growth careers, I'm telling you, we're doing the wrong thing. If we're not enabling folks to be able to get there, we're not going to strengthen their ability. We're not going to help them achieve economic self-sufficiency. So whatever we're doing, we have to ask this question. Are we doing this in a way that's enabling them to get where they need to go? some of the things that we know work, but we have to do it the right way, is CTE training, apprenticeship programs, other job-driven training programs. We encourage and suggest strongly that you look for those in your areas. If you didn't already realize this, we always moving away from sequence service models. That's the old WIA tradition of where you start someone that doesn't know English and ESOL, take them to AB, to teach reading and math, ultimately put them in a vocational program to get a certificate, and ultimately get a job with that, and they take 3 or 4 years in a sequence. And we always say, let's not focus so much on the sequence, let's focus on the career services that are listed below. I'm not going to read all those to you, but you see what they're talking about here. From the very beginning, when you do an outreach to the intake, to the very end, where you're doing the job search and placement assistance and the follow-up and workplace counseling and related assistance services, all those are career services that can help us get this individual in a non-sequential way to where we want them to be. Related assistance, we talked about emergency assistance being in Florida a statewide provided function, and there's a separate RFA for that process. But the whole idea of related assistance is to overcome educational barriers, things that get in the way. So anything that's going to help them, whether it be workplace pesticide safety training, heat stress prevention, English language instruction, allowance payments, other stabilizing support services such as transportation, family care, medical care, are allowable and supported as long as it makes sense, as long as it helps them go down that pathway to where they need to go. Okay, here's some of the special conditions. I'm not going to go over all of them, but just kind of focus on some of the key ones. For sure, comply with the Dewey Green Book. The General Assurance's Terms and Conditions is a very important document that has to be signed by your agency head. And if that changes, because the agency head changed or there's some other change, it's going to get re-signed. So make sure you have a current General Assurance's Terms and Conditions document. And also be aware of the fact, you already know this, but be aware of the fact that if it looks like there's going to be a failure to meet performance goals, that we are within our authority to take a look at your funding and then realign it as best we can so that we can make sure that we, by the end of the program year, put the federal funding in the place where it needs to be in order for us to be able to get where we want to go. If there's any problem with resolution of program or fiscal monitoring findings, that might also be a reason why we want to look at your funding. So please pay close attention to these processes as we move forward. We have a lot of policies in the office dealing with how you submit budget amendments, to how you do eligibility things, how you do an IEP. You know, there's a lot of things you have to make sure you pay attention to those policies. If you've got any questions about any of those, go to our website. You can find them there or call me, and we can certainly go over them. We need you to be able to use online databases to enter the data, update it, store it, and validate participant information required. What does that mean? It means that during our annual review of your programs, one of the things we do is data validation, primarily because we're concerned that we don't want to have a federal auditor come down and make sure that the information isn't valid, particularly as it relates to eligibility. And that means that we take a look at the source documents and make sure that the source documents match what's in your data system. I put a note here that we're moving to a new data system as of October 1, 2016. I'm not going to spend a lot of time at this juncture talking about that. You'll hear a lot more information about this as we move forward. But I'm excited about it. I think it's going to give us a lot more robust kind of data support that's directly aligned with our career source brethren. I think it's going to work really well. Let's talk about the eligibility determination process just a little bit. I mentioned this earlier about the source documentation. But what I want to focus on is all SCDP staff that make decisions in eligibility. And I point this out because we now have new folks coming on board. You know, I just seen in the last several months, we've got new hires, and we're going to get more over the next several months. They have to be certified by attending and completing the MSFW eligibility training provided by the state office. If you've got any questions about that, we have a policy on that. Contact Shirley Cavanteas. She can let you know when the next training is available. She can tell you how the certification process works. And it actually literally is a certification process where you take the course and you take a test and you get a certificate that says you're now certified to do this eligibility training. It's that critically important that the folks that make these decisions know how to do that. Going on, special conditions in attachment B, again, I want to really have you read information as it relates to IEPs and monitoring plan progress on these IEPs. I want to focus on that second bullet there where it talks about participant on track metric. What is that about? Here's what it's about is I've been seeing a lot of situations where you build a plan and then 3 months later it changed, and 6 months after that it changed again. Or what's worse is they start on the plan and they just kind of not really making any progress. So I need to have some way, a metric, if you will, of assessing whether or not the participants are on track as it relates to their plan. So if I were to tell you, for example, you know, 75% of the people that you are paying for are not on track as it relates to their plan, wouldn't that concern you? Well, of course it would. As compared to saying, well, you know, 90% are on track. Well, see, that tells me that somebody is watching what's going on and keeping an eye on what they're doing and making sure that if they start to veer off track, that you've taken some kind of action to get them back on track. So if I don't have this kind of tool that's going to allow me to assess whether or not you're on track, I don't know whether or not you know whether or not the folks are actually making the progress that they're supposed to be making according to their plan. Now, I realize that sometimes things change, and sometimes you have to revise the plan. Okay, now it's different than not being on track, because once you revise the plan, it's kind of like revising the budget. Okay, we've made an adjustment based on this happening, and now as it relates to this new adjustment, we're still on track. Okay, that's what we should be doing, is looking at the plan in an ongoing way throughout the year to make sure that it matches reality. There are limits to that. We don't want you changing the plan every day. There's policy on that. You know, by the third time you change the plan, this office needs to be involved because we want to be part of the process of helping you figure out why the plans aren't working. You know, what are we not doing right to make sure that the individual's plan is what it should be to get them where they need to go? There's a lot of information about job-driven training in the attachment D. I'd like to focus on this development of the eligible training provider list. Most of you that work for school districts and tech centers and colleges already have in-house training, and I understand that. But also, I realize a lot of you do other training through other sources. Those other trainings through other sources, we need to know about who they are and whether or not they're actually doing training in the right way according to the right guidelines to make sure that the ultimate goal is met of getting these folks where they need to go. One of the issues that I've recently found out that I'd like you to really focus on is as you collaborate with your local workforce development board, they also have these eligible training provider lists. I just left one county where they had a list of 30 educational training providers that most of them are related to helping people get jobs, and the school district only knew about maybe 4 or 5 of those. So you see what I'm saying is that part of the agreement and the collaboration that I want you to do with your MOU and your career source centers is to take a look at these training providers that they're using, because we may be able to use the same providers and hopefully sometimes get them to help us pay for getting the training provided for our participants. Placement and transition is a really important process as it relates to the career source process. They're the ones that really have the relationships in place to be able to make the placement transition happen. We need to figure out how to build these working partnerships to make sure that the employment-related community agencies and services are working well with us and that all the things that we're doing are actually helping us get where we want to go. It's important as you go through that process that you document all these things in the case notes and you put in placement sections. That's the only way that we know what's really happening. Fall retention is kind of like a bread and butter as it relates to our reports to Department of Labor. This is a critically important part of what we do. If it's not done on time, if it's not done accurately, if for some reason there's an issue that's not allowing you to put the information in there, then it's going to cost us in terms of the ultimate values that we report to Department of Labor. And it literally could be the case that you're doing the work, you got the good job, but it's not reported, and therefore we're not getting credit for it. So this idea of follow-up retention is really important that we take a hard look at and that you think about as you design your application. The employee Florida Marketplace registration is something we've had in place for a while. Under the new data system, this is going to happen automatically, so it'll be easier to make that happen. Make sure that you really focus, and I know that a lot of you already are, on the employability skills training. Either that should be a standalone program that you provide or that you work through a provider to help people understand what are those skills they need to be able to get that job, keep that job, be able to move forward to a better job. Work experience is something that's really important, I think, in helping people move forward in that employability skills area. But we had to be careful with work experience because it sometimes can be abused. By that I mean that the work experience should be related to the individual employment plan employment goal. It's not really designed to be a part-time job or just to give someone a way to, you know, get some experience showing up to work on time. Well, you can do that for a little bit of time, but the idea is to help get experience in the work that we're training them for, and that way we can take advantage of the dollars that we're spending. This program branding area is real important, I think, to get the word out there about who we are, particularly if we're buried in an organization that has a different mission or a mission maybe that isn't exactly focused as ours is. So my request is that all the information that you put out there, whether it be in brochures, whether it be the way you answer the telephone, whether you do business cards, that it clearly specify that your program is the former career development program of, you know, whatever your agency is. Time and effort reporting is a federal requirement. This hasn't changed a whole lot. I think most of those are 100% time and effort. We just had to do the same annual reporting, but those of you that have partially funded staff need to do the monthly PARs. Those need to be submitted to our office, and Shirley Quantas is the individual that handles that. This area of staffing parameters I mentioned earlier, this is where we have created benchmarks. Take a look at the chart there in attachment B based on your site size as to what the salary and benefit caps are. If for some reason that doesn't work for you, there is a way that you can justify having a little bit more in terms of salary and benefits, but it has to be, again, justified, and typically should be related to service area coverage requirements or some other major issue, and it has to be approved by this office. We need to make sure that the position descriptions and the resumes of the incumbents are aligned with what we're supposed to be doing. And so we have there's a policy in place out of this office that we have to have current copies of those descriptions and resumes for any grant funded position. Any new coordinators must attend new project coordinator training. And any coordinator or case manager that you have out there working this program has to attend annual and content-specific professional development just to make sure that we're doing what we're supposed to be doing. If anything changes, again, make sure that we're aware of it. Make sure you change the new position description, the new resumes, and that you update the staffing form as necessary. Cost standards, we already talked about this, but just make sure that we follow these cost standards in terms of the reasonable and necessary allocableness of the dollars. Program costs, again, these are in the green book, that we don't exceed 5%. That includes indirect costs, by the way. We do make sure that the expenditures are cited on the form, in fact, align with what's in the budget. And we check that on a regular basis. Any changes to the budget must be done in accordance with the Green Book by doing a DOE 150 and 151, and you'd submit that through the process identified in the Green Book. It's important, I think, and helpful if you send us a copy of that amendment. That way we can start the review process so that when it gets here, we can minimize delays. We talked about collaboration already, especially as it relates to providing key community stakeholder input to what we do. I didn't talk a whole lot about Title I Migrant Aid Office, but this is another important partner that we need to reach out to if you haven't already, because obviously the Office of Serving Migrant Children has a direct link to their parents, which are also typically migrants, and there could be some kind of collaboration between our programs that could help the entire family. As I mentioned earlier, we do have dollars that can also help the family. We talked about the Local Workforce Development Board MOU. Again, reach out to me if you want a sample of one that we think covers most everything. It must identify clearly what each party is bringing to the table. And it's also important, if you didn't realize it, that under WIOA, the FCDP program is a mandatory partner of the One Stop Career Center team. Travel costs, this hasn't changed. We need to approve any out-of-state travel out of this office. And of course, you can only incur travel for people that are going to be funded by this program, to be paid by this program. We talked about project amendments already. We already mentioned the electronic budget and monthly disbursement reports. Just keep in mind that we need those by the 20th of the month for the prior month. And again, I can work specifically with the budget officers to be able to make sure those are accurate and correct. There is the closeout. Again, we can do that electronically now that we have this E-59 system. This program non-compliance policy, again, right out of the Green Book, is that based on the stressful conditions. If you fail to provide services as stipulated in your response to the RFA, then that may impact your ability to continue your program. Again, this is standard stuff dealing with property, record retention. Refer to the Green Book for information on these. Same with auditors. Just be aware of the fact that none of this has changed. It's pretty much the same as it's been all along. Insurance as well. I got some links here that I would encourage you to go look at, particularly as it relates to WIOA. There's also links to the terms, conditions, and assurances document that we mentioned earlier. Here's the uniform guidance. Here's the Green Book. If you haven't seen the new Green Book, go here. Here's the Edgar link. That also has been updated. So take advantage of this information. If you have any questions at all about any of these issues before you do the application. Okay, questions. I know there's a lot of information, real quick, but I want to just do your time, so you tell me what it is that maybe I said that was too fast or confusing. No one's got any questions? Okay, I'm going to count to three. If there's no questions after three, then we're done. I'm going to wait. Just make sure if you're on mute that you get yourself off mute.
Yeah, you have to get them off mute first.
Mario, this is Jeannie Russell. Are these slides available on the website?
Not yet.
Okay. Will they be?
They will be.
Okay.
I did send them to you, though.
Okay.
They should be attached to an email I sent you this morning.
Oh, okay. I haven't seen that.
Yeah.
Okay. No problem. Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions? Don't forget to take yourself off mute. I think I just heard someone come on.
Hello?
Yes.
Do you have a template for the budget narrative?
Okay. Say it again, please.
Do you have a template for the budget narrative?
The best template I can give you is what's in the RFA.
Okay.
Take a look at the sections that I described there in terms of product design and implementation. There's a section there in the budget. And then if you turn the page, it talks about all the specific things that need to be in the budget. If for some reason you need additional information, just give me a call, and I can send you some additional information. But the RFA is your best source. Gloria, do you know of any other information on the budget narrative that they could have?
No. Anything specific, you can always reach out to us, but we put a good example in the application.
Okay, thank you.
And when you look at the 599, I think that's a great example of the allowable budget categories.
Yes.
So as long as you stay within the 599 categories and give a description of who, what, when, where, and how many, and why, that'll be great.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Anybody else? Did I just hear somebody come on? Just make sure you take yourself off mute. Yeah. Okay, I think that's one dropping off. All right, if there's no further questions, then I am available. Call me, email me, and certainly glad to respond to your questions. I look forward to seeing your applications. Thank you so much. This concludes this call. Thank you.